One of the greatest pitchers ever to take the mound for the Toronto Blue Jays, and then, of course, for the Philadelphia Phillies, and really in all of Major League Baseball, Roy Halladay, who would have turned 43 today. And that's fitting. It's perfect timing, as we are joined by Philadelphia Phillies beat reporter at MLB.com, and he's also the author of The Life of Roy Halladay. Todd Zielecki joins us. Todd, thanks so much for taking the time, and you know, kind of unique to have you on today. Unfortunately, you know, Roy is not with us for to celebrate his 43rd birthday. But you know, when you The Life of Roy Halladay, this book, when you start it, do you go in having a game plan? Or do you not want to have too much of a game plan because you might uncover things you don't expect?
Well, I tried to go in with an open mind, but there were a couple of reasons why I wanted to write the book, which was, you know, everybody in Toronto, certainly in Canada, knows the story of, you know, former first-round draft pick, almost threw a no-hitter in his second big league start, terrible in 2000, gets sent down to Dunedin, right, and then he kind of resurrects his career. Everybody kind of knew the gist of that story, but I just thought it was such an amazing turnaround, so I wanted to kind of dig into that more. And then the second part of Roy's life that really fascinated me was, think how much money he made and how successful he was, right? He made over $150 million probably in his big league career. And then after his career was over, he took a job as a mental skills coach on the minor league side for the Phillies. And it always, that just kind of really piqued my interest, because most guys with that much success, you know, they might be a broadcaster or they might become a club ambassador, you know, shake some hands, play a few rounds of golf every year. But the fact that he actually had office hours and emailed, texted, called minor league players to try to help them out on the mental side of the game, I wanted to get into that more. And then as I kind of got into it more, I realized just how much of the mental, you know, the mental side of the game was important to him, and how much he kind of struggled that with that throughout his entire life.
Well, let's go back then when he was, you know, as a young guy coming up. Was it always baseball for him, or was he mixing in other sports as well?
You know, it really was baseball for him. You know, his dad really pushed him hard to become a baseball player. You know, but Roy, you know, he's very athletic, certainly. So he played basketball. He ran cross country. He ran cross country, though, because he wanted to build up his endurance for baseball. And at one point, he played basketball, and his dad basically said, hey, you know, how about you play basketball for fun, but make baseball your number one sport. So that was really the focus of his life growing up, was, you know, bullpen sessions in his basement in the winters in Colorado. You know, his dad built him a batting cage in the basement. There was weight training. There was running. You know, he really was built from a young age to be a baseball player.
And where did his dad get this knowledge? Was it was he a player prior to that, or did he just read a lot?
He played a little bit. He was kind of like, you know, he was a good baseball player growing up. He was an outfielder with a strong arm, and he just thought that, you know what, if I train my son hard enough, I could maybe make him better than me and make him maybe get a Division I college scholarship, or maybe even be a little bit better than that. But it wasn't like Roy's dad was a minor leaguer or, you know, just on the cusp of getting drafted or a really successful Division I player. He was just a guy that played baseball, was pretty good at it, but wanted to make his son one of the best.
Todd Zielecki joins us. We are discussing the life of Roy Halladay. He's got his new book out, The Life of Roy Halladay. It's called Doc, actually. And Todd, when you dig into his life, and then he gets into, you know, like most players, you get to the majors, and you mention his second start. And I remember it vividly, because people are like, oh my goodness, who is this guy? But then you were wondering, flash in the pan. What happened after that great second start for Roy was, you know, I don't know if you spoke to him or his coaches or whoever, for him to have to go back down and kind of fight his way back up. What happened?
So after that start, he felt a lot of pressure. Well, a couple things came into play. One is he had this really over-the-top delivery. I don't know if you remember. They called him Iron Mike, like the old batting practice machine, that just kind of the arm would slowly rotate up and fling it over the top of your head. So he was very easily hittable. Hitters could see his fastball really well. He couldn't throw his curveball for strikes. So he basically couldn't throw anything over the plate, otherwise he would get crushed. So that started happening a little bit more, And now his confidence is shot. That 2000 season, he has a 10.64 ERA. And, you know, it's funny. When I saw that, I'm like, wow, that's terrible, right? 10.64 ERA. But it's still the single season highest ERA in baseball history of any pitcher that's ever thrown 50 or more innings in a season. So even then you go, wow, that's the worst. But then you look at Hall of Famers are never that bad. They're never that bad. They don't even come close to being as bad as Roy Halladay was that year. But he gets sent down to A-ball. He meets Mel Queen. He changes delivery. And then he meets Harvey Dorfman, the sports psychologist. And that's when things really started to turn for Roy. The mental side of the game affected him so much. He was always looking at big picture. I need to go out tonight. I need to go 7 innings, 3 runs or less, or I'm going to be a failure. That's how he felt. And then Harvey Dorfman taught him, forget that. Just focus on the next pitch. If you give up a home run, forget about it. Focus on the next pitch. And that kind of took a lot of pressure off of him.
How quickly did it take him to adopt those techniques or that way of thinking?
It actually, you know, it was a constant process for him. His wife, Brandy, found Harvey Dorfman's book, The Mental ABCs of Pitching, and he devoured it. And he read it about, so he pitched, came back in 2001, pitched pretty well. He read it about 6 times from cover to cover during the 2002 season, and then he actually met Harvey Dorfman. And then they began this lifelong friendship and relationship. But he really practiced what Harvey preached, and he picked up on it immediately, and he followed it almost verbatim. So it was he was a pretty good student. Like, I'm reading some old interviews from Harvey, like Roy was one of the guys that didn't just walk the walk, you know, or talk the talk, he walked the walk. And I think that the mental side of the game for Roy, and I get into a lot of this in the book, is really what kind of elevated him from, you know, talented pitcher, pretty good pitcher, to eventual Hall of Fame pitcher.
Todd Zielecki joins us, author of Doc, The Life of Roy Halladay. And Todd, what in your research for the book surprised you most about Roy?
I think what surprised me the most was how much the, you know, being pushed at a young age affected him throughout his life. You know, one of his first memories growing up was being yelled at on a Little League field. I mean, he felt a lot of pressure as a kid. There were some uncomfortable car rides home. And that kind of, you know, as a kid, you go through some of that stuff. It really does affect you. And he had a lot of confidence issues, anxiety issues. He felt the need to please people. And that kind of developed into the pressures that he felt early in his career. And that was a kind of a constant battle for him. And what's interesting about that is you could say, well, if Roy's dad didn't push him to become a great pitcher, maybe he doesn't become a great pitcher. But conversely, and I think Roy agreed to that several times in his life, but conversely, after his career was over and when he started coaching his sons, he made a point not to almost be the opposite of that. He wanted his kids to have, his two boys to have fun playing baseball. He would have parents come up to him all the time and say, hey, Roy, how do I get my kid a D1 scholarship? He'd say, let him have fun first. Teach him to enjoy the game first. And when he coached kids, he would have the parents even sign contracts. And the contracts basically said, don't yell at your son on the field. Don't yell at me in the field. Don't act like, you know, this is the big leagues. This is not the big leagues. If you don't behave properly, what I consider to be proper behavior, you will not be allowed to come to the game. And if you don't stop, your son will not play. I mean, so he wanted to make sure that what he kind of went through as a kid and what he felt and experienced as a kid, other kids did not kind of go through that same thing as they grew up.
Do you know how that was received by those players and those parents at all?
Yeah, you know, I talked to a couple parents, and they loved it. You know, they thought it was great, you know, to kind of set that standard early on. And I mean, and the cool part of it is, you think about it, like, Roy Halladay is coaching your kid, and Roy Halladay's dad says, back off, we're going to do it this way, or you're not going to do it at all. I mean, and they were like, okay. I mean, Roy Halladay is telling us this is the best way to do it. This is the way we're going to do it. But the parents that worked with him and saw him, they loved him, you know, and the players loved him too. I mean, they really, you know, they called him a gentle giant and just a great all around person. They really enjoyed, you know, having Roy Halladay coach their kids.
Yeah, and, you know, I do wonder if it's because, you know, it's Roy Halladay, because I think that's a fantastic contract to just say, you know what, you know, you don't need to yell. Now, the other side, people will say, well, what do you mean? Roy Halladay's dad yelled at him, and it worked, right? So there's, I don't know if there's one perfect way to do it. I wonder just how much of it is just sheer athleticism, right? Like, his dad might have pushed him, but eventually Roy had to push himself.
Absolutely. You know, he doesn't get there without talent. Like, Roy Halladay's dad could have coached me, and I never would have sniffed the big leagues, much less getting drafted. You know what I mean? So, yeah, he certainly had physical talents and capabilities to kind of deliver the goods, so to speak. You know, but yeah, in talking to his family, and I talked to one of his sisters, Heather, and she said that she's like, you know, I think my dad pushed him because he thought that he could handle it. If he didn't think that he could handle it, he might not have done it. But you know, was it worth it? Was the price that he paid worth it? You know, sometimes Roy would say yes, but again, you know, it also affected him mentally and emotionally at times.
You know, he was with Toronto for a number of years, and then, you know, kind of unfortunately for Blue Jays fans, he is traded to Philadelphia. Was that something that was, you know, marked as a big point? Obviously, a big point in his life, but like emotionally, was it a big point in his life to be traded to the Phillies?
It was, and you know, I wrote an entire chapter about this in the book, and I talked to Alex Anthopoulos and JP Ricciardi and a bunch of the Phillies front office officials and Roy's agents as well. And you know, Roy was frustrated. You know, he talked about it. You know, think about Roy. He didn't really say much publicly, but he was kind of vocal at times in that 2009 season about being traded. And he just wanted a chance to see if he could measure up in the postseason. He knew he could do it in the regular season, but he saw Chris Carpenter, his best friend, win a World Series with the Cardinals. He saw other pitchers in the postseason. He just wanted to know, if I get out there, can I actually do it? And you know, so he basically, you know, demanded the trade. He had the full no trade clause. He told Alex after JP got fired. He told Alex and Paul Beeston, said, "Listen, I love it here. I really wanted to win here. You guys are going to rebuild again. Trade me because I'm not going to resign. You could offer me $1 billion. I just, it's not about the money. It's about competing in the postseason." And I thought Alex Anthopoulos, you know, I talked with him and he made a pretty good point. He's like, you know, I feel so bad, you know, for Blue Jays fans, and because when people think of Roy Halladay's greatest moments, they think of the perfect game, right? And then they think of the postseason no-hitter. And he's like, it's no fault of his. I mean, he did everything he could. We just couldn't get him to the postseason. And that was, it was like this tinge of regret in Alex's voice. Like, I wish we could have gotten him to that stage just once in a Blue Jays uniform.
Of course, you know, in Philadelphia, personally and as a team, that's where he had the most success for him. When you talk to him and his family, did that, you know, did winning, you know, did it scratch the itch, you know, that most players have for Roy Halladay, or that quest for him always for looking more, was it still there?
Yeah, it definitely scratched the itch. You know, he threw that, you know, obviously he throws the no-hitter in his first postseason start. And, you know, he had a couple other starts after that in 2010 and 2011. And he said afterward, you know what, I never won the World Series. That's why I came to Philadelphia. I wanted to win a World Series. But really, what I wanted to know was, could I do it? And, again, like I mentioned earlier, like, he watched Chris Carpenter just dominate in the postseason, and he saw all these other pitchers that he beat in the regular season get World Series rings and pitch great in the postseason. And I think the fact that when he went out there, he pitched well and he could handle the pressure and thrive under the spotlight, I think definitely scratched that itch for him. It definitely did.
Why did he have maybe that, not insecurity, but maybe those questions lingering when he already had, you know, quite a good career up to that point?
You know, I think it was just because he hadn't done it before, and okay. he had trained himself and mentally prepared himself so well to just go through that grind of the regular season. And You know, unfortunately for him, he wasn't in a lot of big games. Now he believed that the way he prepared mentally would have him ready to pitch in a big game or not. But because he had never been in that atmosphere, he just didn't totally know for sure. And I guess that's why he was, I can't even say anxious. He just wondered. He just really wanted to know, am I going to feel pressure? Am I going to be nervous? But what was interesting is that before that first start, when he threw that no-hitter, he said he was as confident as he had ever been in his entire life before a start. I mean, he felt that way because he had 9 days before his final start and the first start of the postseason. And he said in an interview, I knew that the Reds could not out-prepare me. I had 9 days. He's like, I studied every hitter so many times. Not only did he study the regulars in that lineup, he studied Reds pitchers that he thought might come in and hit if Edinson Volquez got knocked out of the game early. And sure enough, he got knocked out early. Travis Wood came up like in the third or fourth inning, and he had actually studied game film on how to get him out. I mean, that's how prepared he was for that start.
Todd, it's interesting. He won his first Cy Young with Toronto when he was 26 in 2003. Then he won, of course, his second one with the Phillies in 2010. But a lot of us might forget, like, he finished second in voting twice. He finished third. He finished fifth. Like, he was dominant, really, for, right from 2003 through to 2011-12. Like, that stretch of 9 years, when you put it up against some of the all-time greats, he's right up there.
Oh, he's definitely right up there. And I don't know what how you guys feel about like the modern analytics and whatnot, but if you like kind of consider WAR a little bit, I mean, he was easily the most dominant pitcher of the era. And if you look at some of those Cy Young races, it's interesting now, like if you would go back and vote on some of those races, he probably wins another couple Cy Young awards with the Blue Jays. I mean, there were some seasons where Roy would go like 19-7 with a 2.6 ERA in the AL East. And he would lose to, like, Barry Zito because Barry Zito won, like, 20 games. Like, because Barry Zito won 20 games, he got it. Roy didn't, even though Roy was by far the more dominant pitcher because he was facing the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Rays and the Orioles all the time. You know, like, he had it so much harder than everybody else. And not only did he face those teams, he was always going 8-9 innings. I mean, he was so dominant and so good. I mean, he definitely the best pitcher of his era. He should have at least one or two more Cy Young awards, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's fair. Now, we have to talk about it, of course, afterwards. And, there was lots of the toxicology report recently has come out. What did you make of what happened on the day when Roy passed away?
In terms of what happened that day, I mean, certainly, I think the toxicology report and the NTSB report kind of speaks for itself. He had drugs in his system. He was flying erratically. I think two of those things coincided. It played a role in the crash. Now, what exactly happened at that moment, I don't know. He certainly was flying erratically. I talked to Brandy for the book, and she said, I can't deny the fact that he was flying erratically. Roy's dad is a pilot. That's how Roy became a pilot and got his love of flying. And Roy's dad said he talked to countless people about what might have happened, mechanical failure, this or that. And in the end, he said, I finally stopped asking the question because the only person that can tell me what happened in that during that flight is Roy, and Roy can't tell me because he's gone. Now, what led to that flight, why he was on medications and things like that, I mean, that's, there's a whole ball of wax that I get into. I mean, but to make a long story short, he had really bad back problems the final 2 years of his career. He felt such an obligation to perform at an elite level. He started taking painkillers because he thought maybe I could pitch through this. You take painkillers long enough, you become addicted, and then it kind of snowballed from there. And he just couldn't kick. He couldn't get out of it.
Did he go to rehab about it?
Yeah. So he went to rehab twice. The first time he went, he didn't last long because he started getting recognized there, and he got paranoid. He's like, "Oh my gosh, someone's gonna like take a picture of me and put it on the internet." So he left. He didn't end up going back a second time. And certainly the end of Roy's life is tragic, regardless. But in talking to Roy's wife and then family members, they really do believe that he was slowly starting to turn a corner in his personal life. Now, he wasn't, he hadn't kicked his addictions and his demons by any means, but he was starting to make improvement. And that was kind of the consensus of everybody I talked to, that, you know, I believe with a little bit more time, he would have been able to get past this. And certainly, you know, it's so sad that he was unable to get past it, or at least see if he could get past it.
You know, I thought the statement made by his wife, Brandy Holiday, so it was really strong. Maybe talk about what she said and what you think that kind of did to just kind of make us all aware that we are all kind of human.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because one of the reasons why Brandy and I started talking is because so many people develop their own opinions about the toxicology report and about the NTSB report, and they're like, oh, you know, was he this good guy that everybody says he was? Well, and I think she put it best. You know, everybody has struggles. Like, so what's easy for me to deal with might be really hard for you to deal with, and what might be really hard for you to deal with, it might be really easy for me to deal with, and there's no telling what's going on in somebody's personal life. And with Roy, you know, it started as, he felt pressure to perform, because he was one of the best pitchers in baseball, started taking the pain medications. His career did not end up like he wanted it to. He felt he was disappointed with how his career ended. Those last two seasons in Philly weren't very great. And, you know, he battled depression, anxiety. He started taking antidepressants and things like that. And it just kind of snowballed. But, you know, and her point, again, is, you know, just because you're a big league baseball player, just because you're Roy Halladay, doesn't mean you're not a real human being. It doesn't mean that you don't have real feelings and emotions and go through things. And he certainly did.
In all your research and conversations, and I'm sure you talked to a lot of his teammates over that time, how was Roy perceived by his teammates?
Everybody I talked to still, I mean, the love that they feel for this guy is incredible. I talked to some of his catchers, and I mean, I talked to a lot of his catchers and just a lot of his teammates, managers, pitching coaches, and some of these guys would well up and get choked up talking about him. They're like, I haven't talked about Roy in a year and a half, and, you know, gosh, yeah, just they break down talking about this man because he meant so much to them, because he was just a tremendous role model. You know, think about how hard he worked every day, not just the days he pitched, but the stories of his workouts are legendary, and players loved him for that. And, you know, nothing that happened late in his life is going to change that feeling. You know, he was a great teammate. He was a great person. They enjoyed being around him. Some of the younger guys could be intimidated by him a little bit, but for the most part, everybody that I talked to for this book that knew Roy well still reveres him to this day.
You know, you talked about that relationship with the back catcher, the catcher, and it seems to me that's a pretty important relationship. You know, how did the relationship by the catchers with Roy differ from maybe some of the other pitchers? Was it more intense? Was it more relaxed? Was he more prepared, less prepared? Like, I'm interested in those details.
Yeah, you know what? It was definitely more intense because Roy studied like nobody else studied. He was kind of advanced. Before, like, all the sabermetrics could break down hitters' hot zones and you know, swing tendencies and all that stuff, he did a lot of studying. I mean, he studied these guys like crazy. On flights, Roy would have two iPads on his tray tables in front of him. On the left side, it would be the last 20 at-bats a hitter faced against a right-hander. On the iPad on the right, it would be the last 10 at-bats he faced against that hitter. And he would just kind of go back and forth and study guys. But so in terms of how that went into his relationship with a catcher, most of the time, a catcher, a pitching coach, and a pitcher will meet before a game. And they'll be like, it's like a good give and take. It's like a little committee. Not when Roy Halladay pitched. When Roy Halladay pitched, the pitching coach and the catcher stayed quiet. Roy said, this is what I want you to do. There were many times, it was funny how many catchers said this, not only from the Blue Jays days, but from the Phillies days as well. They would say, Roy would say to him, okay, we're going to go cutter in, out here, sinker in. I'm not going to go sinker away. We're going to front, I'll go curveball away. We're not going to front door it. And so there was catchers that would say, like, during a game, it'd be the seventh inning, I'd be 98 pitches in, I would forget, and I'd call front door or curveball or whatever. And Roy would step off the mound and look at him like, are you kidding me, dude? I just told you this 4 hours ago. Like he didn't say it with words. He said it with a look, and the catcher would be like, "Oh my God, oh my God, I'm so sorry." So there were, I mean, that was, you know, there was a lot of great stories like that. But then there are moments when. Rob Barajas told me a great story where B.J. Upton, it was something like, you know, I do not want you throwing cutters. I'm not throwing cutters away to B.J. Upton. And so they didn't all game. Well, in a late inning at bat, B.J. Upton kind of moved in on the plate, moved up on the plate. It might have been sinkers in. Anyway, Barajas saw that B.J. Upton kind of was cheating in on the plate a little bit. So he kind of looked at B.J.'s feet. He looked at Roy. He called for the pitch. Roy specifically told him before the game, do not call this pitch, come hell or high water. He called it, called strike three. Rob Barajas said, I've never felt more proud in my life. Like, you kind of walk in with your chest out, you kind of give a nod to Roy. Roy kind of looks at you like, great job. And he's like, you never feel greater than when you can actually do something great for Roy Halladay. So there's so many of those stories, like Roy going to the mound, or a catcher going to the mound, and Roy going, why are you here, like, you know, he would add in a little word I can't say on the radio, but get back, turn around and go back behind the plate. I mean, it was an intense relationship, but it was a good relationship. And again, all of those catchers talk about this guy like, I'm so blessed that I got to catch Roy Halladay because it was one of the highlights of my career.
Well, I would think at times he would make the catcher's job a little bit easier because he's like, all right, Roy knows what he's pitching, yeah, right. So I don't have to worry as much.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those guys said it was just great. You could go behind the plate, you'd put the glove out, he would hit his spot every single time. You know, and I talked with Greg Zahn. He said, you know, Greg's like, you know, the best part was like, you know, he would drop this curveball in and guys would have that little turtle head. They just drop down because they think it was coming towards the neck and it would fall in for a strike. He's like, you know, some of the comments that hitters would make. Kevin Cash, who caught for the Blue Jays, he's now the Rays manager. He said it was great. Like before a game, a hitter would step in the batter's box in the first inning and go, you get to face our guy, and we get to face this guy. This stinks. So that before the game started, hitters were defeated yeah. because they just knew, I'm just going to get my hands hammered on like sinkers in and cutters in or whatever. You know, he had that type of effect on hitters and on catchers and on everybody.
Did Roy have a favorite pitch?
I think, well, the sinker, I think, became like the early part of his success. But I think he really fell in love with his cutter. You know, the famous story is, you know, he asked Mariano Rivera how he was gripping his cutter, because Roy's cutter was good at times, but it would kind of back up on him and give him some problems. And at the All-Star game in July of 2008 at Yankee Stadium, Roy basically went up to Mariano and said, well, how do you grip this thing exactly? And Mariano showed him, and the Yankees were so mad at Mariano for, like, you just gave Roy Halladay your cutter grip? Are you crazy? But I think he loved that pitch because I think once he could get the cutter down with the sinker, he could kind of X both sides of the plate. And I think that once he got that going, and talking to hitters that faced him around that time, they said once he got the cutter going, it was like, forget about it. We have no chance.
Awesome stuff. Todd, where's the best place people can get the book?
Well, you know, anywhere online right now, I know most bookstores are closed. So, you know, Amazon, Indigo up there, right? Anywhere you can get a book online, you can get Doc, The Life of Roy Halladay.
Well, it sounds awesome. I look forward to reading it. Appreciate your time, Todd.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. I had fun.